Supreme Court 7 years after Roe, when it upheld a ban on federal funding for abortion. The burden of privacy fell on poor women's shoulders. What if a woman wanted to stay pregnant, like Strzok? Was her right to continue working free from discrimination protected by the right to privacy? That answer came even sooner. Employers had long refused to hire or promote women because they might get pregnant, forced them to take unpaid leave if they did get pregnant, and then refused to give women their jobs back when they were ready to return to work. Such treatment, RBG argued, made assumptions about women's God-given roles just like the laws struck down in Reed and Frontiero did. They were grounded on stereotypes concerning women's physical limitations and proper place in society, RBG wrote in an amicus brief in one of a string of pregnancy-related cases before the Supreme Court in the 70s. These employer policies, RBG wrote, had nothing to do with the nature of women or the realities of pregnancy. That many of these women needed to work when pregnant and parenting didn't seem to register. The notion is that when the woman gets pregnant, she's going to stay home and take care of her baby, everything's wonderful, and she's going to have a husband to support her, RBG said in 1977. Well, the kinds of plaintiffs that came up in these cases were women who had no husbands. They were the sole support of themselves and the child to come. No matter their income, pregnant women were assumed to have taken themselves out of public life. RBG also understood that how pregnant women were treated had to do with sex. Only a woman's body showed proof of having sex, and only women were punished for having it. She wrote to advise the lawyer of a pregnant servicewoman who had gotten a general discharge instead of an honorable one. Surely the less-than-honorable aspect is not getting pregnant, but the conduct, RBG wrote. As for that, it takes two, and no man or no woman, probably, is discharged for having sexual relations. The Supreme Court stubbornly refused to listen to any of this. Excluding pregnancy from a disability plan wasn't necessarily discriminating against women, the justices claimed in 1974 with Geduldig v. Aiello, because not all women are pregnant, even though all pregnant people are women. In another case, female employees sued General Electric, a company that had once made all women quit upon marrying, for excluding pregnancy coverage on its employee plan. GE's lawyer told the Supreme Court with a straight face that, after all, women didn't have to be pregnant. If they wanted to work, GE's attorney suggested, women now had legal access to what he called an in-and-out noon-hour treatment. He meant abortion. Astonishingly, on December 7, 1976, a majority of the Supreme Court agreed. Rehnquist wrote for the majority that pregnancy was special, because unlike race or gender itself, it was often voluntarily undertaken and desired. The message was clear. Once you did the deed, you had to pay the price. That is, if you were a woman. Justices William Brennan and Thurgood Marshall protested in their dissent that GE hadn't left out any so-called voluntary disabilities, including sport injuries, attempted suicides, venereal disease, disabilities incurred in the commission of a crime or during a fight, and elective cosmetic surgery. Within a day of the General Electric decision, RBG called a meeting to map out a Plan B to protect pregnant workers from discrimination. She was very much a leader of the coalition, says fellow feminist lawyer Judith Lichtman. It only took 2 years to overturn a really stinky, can I say shitty, decision, she added. In October 1978, Congress passed the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which made clear that employers would be discriminating against women if they didn't treat pregnant workers like other temporarily disabled workers. Some feminists wanted pregnancy to be recognized as essentially different from sports injuries or elective cosmetic surgery. But RBG was adamant that treating pregnancy as special would backfire. She hoped gender-neutral policies would make it harder for employees to single women out for discrimination. Her experience and clients had convinced her that anything that looked like a favor to women would be used against them. What about the men? Of all of her clients, RBG was fondest of Stephen Wiesenfeld, a single father whose wife had died in childbirth. Bringing his case to the Supreme Court was a chance to show that sexism hurt everybody. While Stephen played homemaker, as the letter that brought him to RBG's attention put it, Paula had worked as a teacher and paid into Social Security. But only widows could get mother's benefits. The law, RBG wrote in her brief to the Supreme Court on Wiesenfeld's behalf, reflects the familiar stereotype that, throughout this nation's history, has operated to devalue women's efforts in the economic sector. Her argument went even further. Just as the female insured individual's status as breadwinner is denigrated, RBG wrote, so the parental status of her surviving spouse is discounted, for the sole reason that appellee is a father, not a mother. He is denied benefits that would permit him to attend personally to the care of his infant son, a child who has no other parent to provide that care. Then she twisted the knife. Their young son, Jason Paul, RBG wrote, was another victim of a law that includes children with dead fathers, but excludes children with dead mothers. RBG found out she won her case by flipping through her car radio on her way to Columbia. My first reaction was that I have to get hold of myself or I'll have an accident, she told a reporter that day. Then, when I got to Columbia, I went running through the halls kissing the students who had worked with me on the case. And I am normally a very unemotional person. She told another friend it had made her cry. Given the purpose of enabling the surviving parent to remain at home to care for a child, the gender-based distinction of the law is entirely irrational, Brennan wrote. Rehnquist, still a women's rights skeptic, concurred, saying he was voting to strike down the law because it harmed the baby. At least he had taken that half step. RBG wrote of the case, Wiesenfeld is part of an evolution toward a policy of neutrality, a policy that will accommodate traditional patterns, but at the same time, one that requires removal of artificial constraints, so that men and women willing to explore their full potential as humans may create new traditions by their actions. She had perplexed and even angered some of her allies by bringing so many cases with male plaintiffs. After all, it was the Women's Rights Project, not the Men's Rights Project. Much later, people would say RBG was a genius for presenting the male-dominated court with their brethren. The truth was more complicated. The choices men like Stephen Wiesenfeld made baffled, even angered the justices. Why would he want to act like a woman? In a way, it was easier to understand why a woman would want to act like a man. RBG firmly believed that for women to be equal, men had to be free. Decades later, an unnamed guest at a dinner party told the New York Times that RBG had vehemently interrupted another guest who mentioned she'd worked on behalf of women's liberation. She turned on him and said, "It is not women's liberation. It is women's and men's liberation." I'd never seen her exercise such strength and vehemence. Nor was she only interested in letting only one or two women into the old boys' network. RBG firmly believed that more women in public life would benefit everyone, including men. Men need to learn, and they do when women show up in their midst in numbers, not as one-at-a-time curiosities, RBG remarked at the 25th anniversary of women at Harvard Law School in 1978. Men need the experience of working with women who demonstrate a wide range of personality characteristics. They need to become working friends with women. By that point, the percentage of women in law schools had risen to 30%. Former Dean Irwin Griswold was worried, he wrote RBG that year, even though, as he reminded her, he had got women into the Harvard Law School as soon as I could after I became dean. Griswold fretted that, between the women, though, and the minorities, the number of places available for white men has sharply dropped. The time may come when some consideration will be given to their plight. RBG, whose daughter Jane was at that time enrolled at Harvard Law School, was unperturbed. She wrote that she was pretty sure more women and people of color could enroll without denying to white men of merit a fair chance to compete for places. That day, triumphantly back at Harvard Law School, RBG looked out at young women, including her daughter, whose road had been smoother. RBG was glad of it. She would soon argue what would turn out to be her last case before the Supreme Court. Slowly but surely, she had built a set of precedents that had walked the justices in her direction, toward recognizing women as people. In her speech, RBG allowed herself a little levity. "I understand some of the men come to HLS these days because..." Here she paused. "What better place to find a suitable woman?" "All male retreats are on the wane," RBG continued. "I expect, before very long, the old boys will find no escape at judges' conference tables." She was right. Chapter 5. Don't let 'em hold you down. Reach for the stars. People often ask me, "Well, did you always want to be a judge?" My answer is it just wasn't in the realm of the possible until Jimmy Carter became president and was determined to draw on the talent of all of the people, not just some of them. RBG, 2010. Like a bride. That's how RBG felt when Bill Clinton ushered her out to the Rose Garden to introduce her as his Supreme Court nominee. Instead of the traditional white, she wore an oversized navy blazer dress and a scrunchie that nearly dwarfed her head. What only a handful of people gathered there knew was that the match almost didn't happen. Less than 24 hours earlier, Clinton had been about to get on the phone and offer his first Supreme Court nomination to someone else, to yet another man. No doubt could be read on Clinton's face that afternoon. He introduced RBG as a hero to the women's movement and a legal star. Above all, Clinton said, he'd chosen her for being a moderate, neither liberal nor conservative, someone whose moral imagination has cooled the fires of her colleagues' discord. Ruth Bader Ginsburg cannot be called a liberal or a conservative. She has proved herself too thoughtful for such labels, the president said. Having experienced discrimination, he added, she devoted the next 20 years of her career to fighting it and making this country a better place for our wives, our mothers, our sisters, and our daughters. RBG would have added, and our husbands, our fathers, our brothers, and our sons. Marty got his own Clinton shout-out, too, as the man whom RBG had married 39 years before. As a very young woman, Clinton assured the crowd with a grin. Clinton didn't mention the other role Marty had played, doing everything in his power to make sure that the president heard about a certain former women's rights lawyer serving as a federal court of appeals judge right there in Washington. "I wasn't important at all," Marty later insisted, but his friend Carr Ferguson gave him away. There were probably scores, maybe hundreds of us, who had been called to lobby on RBG's behalf, anyone they knew in Congress or the White House, in either party. And when Marty heard that RBG's longtime dislike of the Roe decision had earned her the vague reputation of not being trusted by feminists, he pressed into service all of her movement friends. RBG had rarely aggressively sold herself for anything, even by proxy, but one of her clerks told her that if she just waited to be chosen, she might be 25th on the list. She had to admit to herself that she wanted this. Fresh to the presidency, Clinton was having a rough time with any number of appointments, with a succession of political controversies and hasty withdrawals. By June 1993, it had been 4 months since Associate Justice Byron White announced his retirement from the Supreme Court. The names of several possible successors had leaked to the press, though not RBG's. She was in the running, but thought it might be over when White House counsel Bernard Nussbaum told her she could feel free to go to a weekend wedding in Vermont. Then she got a call from Nussbaum, telling her to come back to meet with the president. Another appeals court judge, Stephen Breyer, supposedly had a tax issue, something that had sunk other appointees, and Clinton didn't warm to him. A year later, Clinton would apparently change his mind, nominating Breyer to the court. Mario Cuomo, Clinton's favorite, backed out mere minutes before the president was about to offer it to him. Meeting at the White House on Sunday, Clinton liked RBG immediately. Clinton's staff was relieved that Marty was a tax lawyer, assuming he would have all their affairs in order. In fact, It was RBG who handled all of their personal finances. When the Clinton vetters showed up at the Ginsburgs' apartment in the Watergate building to hurriedly riffle through their tax records, Marty did make them lunch. According to communications staffer George Stephanopoulos, Clinton briefly worried that RBG's support for public funding of abortion would push her out on the cultural left. But he had wanted a history-making candidate, and RBG had made history. Close to midnight, Clinton called RBG and told her he would nominate her to be an associate justice, the second woman ever to sit on the Supreme Court. "Tomorrow morning we'll have a little ceremony in the Rose Garden," Clinton told her. "And of course," he added, "we would like you to make some remarks." That shook RBG out of her euphoria. She went to her desk. Late night had always been her most productive time anyway. There was something else she liked about the speediness of it all. The White House handlers had no time to edit it or suggest changes, she said later of her first words to the nation. "And then I gave it just as I wrote it." The day America met RBG, they saw a woman even many of her friends had never glimpsed. There was no sign of the solemn woman she was said to be behind the enormous violet-tinted glasses that halved her face that afternoon, or in the ebullient grin. She thanked the women's movement that opened doors for people like me, as well as the civil rights movement of the 1960s from which the women's movement drew inspiration. The announcement the president just made is significant, I believe, because it contributes to the end of the days when women, at least half the talent pool in our society, appear in high places only as one-at-a-time performers, RBG said. "I have a last thank you," she said. "It is to my mother, Celia Amster Bader, the bravest and strongest person I have known, who was taken from me much too soon," she said. "I pray that I may be all that she would have been had she lived in an age when women could aspire and achieve, and daughters are cherished as much as sons." Even people who knew her well had never seen her be so emotional, so unguarded. By that point, Bill Clinton was wiping a tear from his cheek. RBG had gotten to carry on her mother's memory before the country. She had even helped a man defy gender stereotypes. Militant Feminist Interpretations. Sometime in the 70s, RBG had been interviewed for a federal district court judge position. The screening committee told her she wasn't qualified because she had no experience in financial securities. "I wonder how many gender discrimination cases they have handled," RBG retorted, but only later, to her friend the legal reporter Nina Totenberg. Anyway, RBG didn't want to be a district court judge, the evidence-heavy first stop for any federal suit. She was more interested in the broader legal questions raised by federal appeals courts. The Supreme Court only takes about 75 cases a year, out of 10,000 it is asked to hear. So appeals court judges just below it are often the final word on the law. Joining such a court long involved knowing the right guy or supporting the right guy's election. Even after clearing that hurdle, old boy network bar associations guarded the doors. No wonder that when Jimmy Carter became president in 1977, just one woman served as an appeals court judge. The Carter administration was determined to do better. Feminist lawyers scrambled to help, forming a new organization to vet judicial candidates on their own metric of commitment to equality. Suddenly, RBG knew a woman. The new group's president was Lynn Hecht Schaffrin, who had been RBG's Columbia Law School student and ACLU intern. As she applied for judicial positions in both the Second Circuit, close to home, and the D.C. Circuit, RBG knew her feminist past might be held against her. In notes to herself labeled Notes from Second Circuit Interview, a whole page preemptively addressed any issues that might come up about bias based on experiences. A list of qualities RBG drew up to describe herself sold the star litigator rather short. It focused not on her brilliant strategy or accomplishments, but on her high capacity for sustained work, accustomed to long hours, homework, extending day as long as necessary to accomplish task needed to be done. She bloodlessly referred to her high-quality standards for own work product, my own sternest critic, and put near the bottom that she was a good sympathetic listener. Overall, RBG wrote, I very much want to be considered on the basis of whatever merit I have, not on the basis of my sex, or views of people who are not in a very good position to evaluate my performance and potential. To paraphrase Grimke, she just wanted the committee to take their feet off her neck. RBG did not make the cut for the Second Circuit, apparently because she had applied to two courts, despite being assured it wouldn't disqualify her. Her letters at the time show her disappointment. I am heartened by the people and groups who have questioned the merit system as it appears to be working or not working in some areas of the country, she wrote feminist lawyer Diane Blank in March 1979. Women in the law who were her protégés or admirers rallied to RBG's side. At least one was inside the Carter administration. I cannot exaggerate the feeling among women lawyers that all increases in numbers or victories are pyrrhic if Ruth is not appointed, wrote Assistant Attorney General Barbara Babcock to Attorney General Griffin Bell on March 12th. It will be viewed as a slap in the face that a woman who is so well qualified, and more than any woman applicant in the country has paid her dues, is not chosen. Babcock sent a blind carbon copy to RBG. Within a month, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's name was before the Senate Judiciary Committee. RBG's fears that her women's rights work would be held against her were briefly borne out. Representative John Ashbrook, a conservative Ohio congressman, complained that she had militant feminist interpretations. Ashbrook's words, RBG wrote her old law professor Herb Wexler, were a gross distortion of my views, testimony, and articles, but I doubt he cares what I did say or write. Luckily, Ashbrook, as a member of the House, did not get a vote. In May 1979, Nina Totenberg rallied to her side in the pages of Legal Times. Republican Judiciary Committee members have dragged their feet, and no firm hearing date has been set, Totenberg wrote. The reason is that the nominee is not a he, but a she, and she is the architect of the legal strategy for the women's movement. But in the end, only legendary segregationist Senator Strom Thurmond voted against her in the Judiciary Committee. In the full Senate, RBG was confirmed unanimously on June 18, 1980. She didn't forget the students and feminist lawyers who had gotten her there. Her former Columbia Law mentee Diane Zimmerman remembers the exuberant party thrown by students and faculty. RBG sat on the floor giggling, eating Kentucky Fried Chicken out of a bucket. The women are against her. Another more staid celebration was held after RBG's swearing-in. She asked Gerald Gunther, her beloved Columbia Law professor who had had to blackmail a judge to hire her as a clerk, to speak. Gunther, the biographer of Judge Learned Hand, told the assembled that RBG would be a judge like Hand, genuinely open-minded and detached, and heedful of limitations stemming from the judge's own competence. Sure, said Republicans and Democrats alike, elbowing him knowingly. The card-carrying member of the ACLU was going to be a judicial moderate? Gunther bet the skeptics $5 that in a couple of years, RBG would widely be seen as the most independent, thoughtful, modest judge on the bench, he later wrote. Within a couple of years, Gunther got a $5 bill in the mail, along with a clipping from the Washington Post describing RBG as a solid centrist. RBG had gotten onto the D.C. circuit just under the wire of the Carter presidency. A year into her term, it was clear she was a long way from the feminist law world. The Reagan and Bush years went on to stack the D.C. circuit with staunch conservatives like Antonin Scalia, Kenneth Starr, Robert Bork, and Clarence Thomas. Her particular appeals court mostly oversaw federal agencies, and the work was often so intricately boring that Marty joked that most cases involved the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Sometimes called the second most important court in the country, the D.C. Circuit was also unmistakably a pipeline to the Supreme Court. The new title did not erase some of the old indignities, however. At RBG's 25th Harvard Law School reunion, someone tried to organize the members of the class and their wives in a group photograph. "What do you mean, wives?" demanded RBG. At cocktail parties, when the host would introduce someone to Judge Ginsburg, a hand was usually outstretched to Marty. As the 80s wore on, some of RBG's D.C. Circuit clerks had trouble even remembering that RBG had made her name litigating women's rights. She was widely regarded not as a women's judge, much less a political judge, but as a judge's judge, two of her former clerks, David and Susan Williams, later wrote, as if being a women's judge was something to shrink away from. RBG saw the role of an appeals court judge as fundamentally different than her old job. She was to follow precedent, not try to change it. And on a court where most decisions were made on a panel of three, RBG developed her fixation on compromise and collegiality. "I don't see myself in the role of a great dissenter, and I would much rather carry another mind, even if it entails certain compromises," RBG said at a roundtable on judging in 1985. "Of course there is a question of bedrock principle where I won't compromise," she added. But she had learned a lot about other minds paying attention to people's personalities in this job. "I take that into account much more than just the ideas that I was dealing with in what I did before I came to the bench." RBG even tried to convince her fellow judges that when they all agreed on an opinion, they should leave off the name of the author entirely so the court could speak in a single voice. None of them liked the idea. RBG's image as a moderate was clinched in March 1993 in a speech she gave at New York University known as the Madison Lecture. "Sweeping judicial opinions," she told the audience, packed with many of her old New York friends, "were counterproductive. Popular movements and legislatures had to first spur social change, or else there would be a backlash to the courts stepping in." As case in point, RBG chose an opinion that was very personal to plenty of people listening, Roe v. Wade. The right had been aiming to overturn Roe for decades. And they'd gotten very close only months before the speech with Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Justices Anthony Kennedy, David Souter, and Sandra Day O'Connor had instead brokered a compromise, allowing states to put restrictions on abortion as long as they didn't pose an undue burden on women or ban it before viability. Neither side was thrilled, but Roe was safe, at least for the moment. Just as feminists had caught their breath, RBG declared that Roe itself was the problem. "If only the court had acted more slowly," RBG said, "and cut down one state law at a time the way she had gotten them to do with the jury and benefit cases. The justices could have been persuaded to build an architecture of women's equality that could house reproductive freedom." She said the very boldness of Roe, striking down all abortion bans until viability, had halted a political process that was moving in a reform direction and thereby, I believe, prolonged divisiveness and deferred stable settlement of the issue. This analysis remains controversial among historians, who say the political process of abortion access had stalled before Roe. Meanwhile, the record shows that there was no overnight eruption after Roe. In 1975, 2 years after the decision, no senator asked Supreme Court nominee John Paul Stevens about abortion. But Republicans, some of whom had been pro-choice, soon learned that being the anti-abortion party promised gains. And even if the court had taken another path, women's sexual liberation and autonomy might have still been profoundly unsettling. Still, RBG stuck to her guns, in the firm belief that lasting change is incremental. For the feminists and lawyers listening to her Madison lecture, RBG's argument felt like a betrayal. At dinner after the lecture, Bert Newborn remembers, other feminists tore into their old friend. They felt that Roe was so precarious, they were worried such an expression from Ruth would lead to it being overturned, he recalls. Not long afterward, when New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan suggested to Clinton that RBG be elevated to the Supreme Court, the president responded, "The women are against her." Ultimately, Irwin Griswold's speech, with its comparison to Thurgood Marshall, helped convince Clinton otherwise. It was almost enough for RBG to forgive Griswold for everything else. A fully adult human, responsible for her own choices. As word leaked out of Clinton's pick for the court, the press struggled to figure RBG out. Was she some sort of flaming feminist? But what, then, explained her baffling D.C. Circuit record? A Legal Times study in 1988 found that RBG had voted with the famously conservative Judge Robert Bork in 85% of the cases where they'd been on a panel together, compared with 38% of the time she voted with a fellow Carter appointee. And yet, 6 years earlier, when Ronald Reagan had nominated Bork to the Supreme Court, liberals had managed to get him tossed out of the running. Senator Ted Kennedy had warned from the Senate floor that Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back-alley abortions, and where blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, among other horrors. Businessweek, at least, comforted its readers with the assurance of one Washington lawyer that the nominee harbors no animosity towards corporate America. Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page asked, "Is Ruth Bader Ginsburg another Thurgood Marshall or another Clarence Thomas?" He did concede that RBG was generally thought to be a sweet lady. Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, who had taught alongside Breyer, begged to differ. Cherry-picking anonymous reviews for his nationally syndicated column, Dershowitz said lawyers found her a picky, impatient, and schoolmarmish judge. As of this writing, no one has come up with a male counterpart to schoolmarmish. Dershowitz claimed that RBG's reputation among her colleagues, judges, law clerks, and lawyers, is that she is a difficult person who alienates many of those around her. Comparing RBG with Thurgood Marshall, said Dershowitz, was denigrating the memory of a hero, because after all, she had only argued a handful of appeals at a time when women's rights were voguish and certainly not career-threatening. Marshall had died 5 months earlier and could not be reached for comment. Another liberal lion and ally of RBG's high court litigation, retired Justice William Brennan, wrote RBG privately. "The president could not have made a better choice," said Brennan, by then nearing 90. RBG replied, "Dear Bill, I love you. Pray for me, Ruth." Now came what Clinton's staffers feared would be the hard part: getting a former feminist litigator and ACLU board member confirmed by the Senate. Committee Republicans are looking for the letters that the president received on behalf of Ginsburg. "They will not get same," wrote one Clinton administration official in notes from a meeting. Rumor is that some abortion rights zealot in the White House advised Marty Ginsburg to start a campaign to overcome questions about her position on choice. In prep sessions, RBG was warned that she would be held accountable for anything the ACLU had ever done, and was advised on how to distance herself. "I said, stop, because I will not do anything to disparage the ACLU," RBG said later. And so they grudgingly gave up. In the end, in the 4 July days in which her nomination was considered, no one asked about the ACLU. The Senate was controlled by Democrats. After the pitched battles over Bork and Thomas, Republicans didn't seem to have much appetite for a fight. Two female senators had even joined the committee in the 2 years since Anita Hill, who had accused Thomas of sexual harassment, had been grilled by a panel of white males. The country was introduced to RBG's slightly alien, flat cadence, stammering out two or three words at a time, punctuated by perplexing silences in the middle of a sentence, as if she was reading aloud in a language not her own. RBG told charming and self-deprecating stories about her family, holding up a book made by Jane's son Paul, called "My Grandma is Very, Very Special." Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joe Biden commented, "I will tell you, Paul, the handwriting is good, the pictures are beautiful, and you don't need a publisher." Her former client Steven Wiesenfeld testified warmly on RBG's behalf, and Biden noted that he, like Wiesenfeld, had been a widowed father. And at Senator Ted Kennedy's prompting, RBG talked about some of the sexist slights she'd experienced over the years. Strom Thurmond did press RBG on abortion. Wouldn't she agree that the judges in the Casey decision cared more about public opinion than what was legally right? RBG replied evenly, I think that every justice of the Supreme Court and every federal judge would subscribe to a principle that a judge must do what he or she determines to be legally right. You are good, Judge, Biden cackled. You are real good. Years later, during John Roberts' close-lipped confirmation hearings, Republicans would cite Ginsburg's careful answers to more pointed questions. Time and again, she would say, I would apply the law to the facts of the case to the best of my abilities, remembered her clerk, Elisa Klein, who sat in on the hearings. Coming from some people, that might be evasive. Anyone who knows her knows that she means what she said. Eventually, conservative women rushed to testify before the Judiciary Committee to register their objections. One said that RBG had demonstrated and spelled out her avowed devotion to privilege for females, showing her tendency to be acutely aware of sex discrimination, not for males, but only for females. After all those years of being accused of advocating too much for the rights of men, RBG must have had a laugh about that one. RBG did not apologize for the ACLU, for being a feminist, or for supporting abortion rights. The decision whether or not to bear a child is central to a woman's life, to her well-being and dignity, she said simply. It is a decision she must make for herself. When government controls that decision for her, she is being treated as less than a fully adult human responsible for her own choices. When RBG's nomination reached the Senate floor, only 3 senators voted against her. A good day in the work of the court. As a new justice, RBG was now allowed into the room where once 9 men had met to discuss the fate of the cases she'd argued decades before. She was part of the conference, where the justices shut the door and say what they really think. No one is allowed in this room but the justices themselves. No secretary, no law clerk, not even a message bearer, as RBG put it. Anything that comes out of that confidential meeting comes from one of them. The only record is handwritten notes, if the justices choose to take them. A few days after oral argument, the justices meet for this conference to discuss the cases they've heard and take a vote. The Chief Justice sits at the head of one side, and the Senior Associate Justice sits at the other. After the Chief Justice has summarized the case, the rest will speak their piece in order of seniority. There isn't much debate that happens in this room, according to RBG, despite the hope of outsiders that the justices might persuade one another at conference. One justice or another will say, after we've talked for several minutes, it will all come out in the writing, RBG said. Then the Chief Justice assigns someone to write an opinion, unless he is in the minority, at which point the responsibility falls to the most senior justice in the minority. RBG's first opinion as a Supreme Court justice was a dauntingly technical one. But 3 years into her tenure, she had a chance to finish something she had started decades before. Throughout the 70s, RBG had represented servicewomen in an ongoing bid to get brass to value their work equally. But the job of securing equality for women in the military was unfinished. Another task was also incomplete. In her WRP years, RBG had never gotten the court to accept strict scrutiny for sex discrimination, the standard that would nearly write gendered categories out of the law. The women who wanted to attend a state's military academy helped her finish the job, this time as a justice. In the 1996 case of the Virginia Military Institute's refusal to admit women, RBG was happy to see that the federal government led the charge against the publicly funded school. For the litigator who had often faced down the federal government as an adversary, that was itself a victory. VMI claimed that admitting women would undermine its mission, which included training cadets by an adversative method, and which the Academy argued couldn't be used to train women. After the federal government filed a discrimination claim, VMI set up a weak imitation at a sister school, which the state named the Virginia Women's Institute for Leadership. What we have here is a single-sex institution for men that's designed as a place to teach manly values that only men can learn, to show that men can suffer adversity and succeed, and a single-sex institution for women that is openly, expressly, deliberately designed to teach women womanly values, feminine values, said Deputy Solicitor General Paul Bender at oral argument. It was the same Paul Bender who had heard Frankfurter reject a female clerk. RBG had just one thing to add. If women are to be leaders in life and in the military, then men have got to become accustomed to taking commands from women, and men won't be accustomed to that if women aren't let in, she said. At conference, the vote, intoxicatingly, came down 7-1, with Justice Clarence Thomas recusing himself because he had a son at BMI and Scalia dissenting. The majority opinion was assigned to RBG. It would be her biggest victory yet. She could even approvingly cite cases she herself had won and repudiate the bad old days, like when Myra Bradwell had been blocked from lawyering just because she was a woman. From BRG's opinion in United States v. Virginia. For additional commentary, please see the enhanced portion of this audiobook. In 1971, for the first time in our nation's history, this court ruled in favor of a woman who complained that her state had denied her the equal protection of its laws. Reed v. Reed, holding unconstitutional Idaho Code prescription that, among several persons claiming and equally entitled to administer a decedent's estate, males must be preferred to females. Since Reed, the court has repeatedly recognized that neither federal nor state government acts compatibly with the equal protection principle when a law or official policy denies to women, simply because they are women, full citizenship stature, equal opportunity to aspire, achieve, participate in, and contribute to society based on their individual talents and capacities. Without equating gender classifications, for all purposes, to classifications based on race or national origin, the court, in post-Reed decisions, has carefully inspected official action that closes a door or denies opportunity to women or to men. To summarize the court's current directions for cases of official classification based on gender, focusing on the differential treatment or denial of opportunity for which relief is sought, the reviewing court must determine whether the proffered justification is exceedingly persuasive. The burden of justification is demanding, and it rests entirely on the state. The state must show, at least, that the challenged classification serves important governmental objectives and that the discriminatory means employed are substantially related to the achievement of those objectives. The justification must be genuine, not hypothesized or invented post hoc in response to litigation. And it must not rely on overbroad generalizations about the different talents, capacities, or preferences of males and females. See Weinberger v. Wiesenfeld, 1975, Califano v. Goldfarb, 1977, Stevens, J., concurring in judgment. Inherent differences between men and women, we have come to appreciate, remain cause for celebration, but not for denigration of the members of either sex or for artificial constraints on an individual's opportunity. Sex classifications may be used to compensate women for particular economic disabilities they have suffered, to promote equal employment opportunity, to advance full development of the talent and capacities of our nation's people. But such classifications may not be used, as they once were, see Gossard, to create or perpetuate the legal, social, and economic inferiority of women. We conclude that Virginia has shown no exceedingly persuasive justification for excluding all women from the citizen soldier training afforded by VMI. A prime part of the history of our Constitution is the story of the extension of constitutional rights and protections to people once ignored or excluded. VMI's story continued as our comprehension of we the people expanded. In his dissent, Justice Antonin Scalia said that the court had snuck in strict scrutiny through the back door. But nothing could temper RBG's joy. I regard the VMI case as the culmination of the 1970s endeavor to open doors so that women could aspire and achieve without artificial constraints, she said. RBG sent a copy of her bench announcement to the 90-year-old Justice Brennan, who had tried to get her 5 votes for strict scrutiny way back in Frontiero. She wrote, "Dear Bill, See how the light you shed has spread. On the day RBG read the opinion from the bench, a half dozen clerks were invited up to Chambers to celebrate. There was no champagne, just an exultant justice. It was the work of the court, said former clerk David Toscano, who was there. It was a good day in the work of the court. A little while later, RBG got a letter. It was from a 1967 graduate of the MI who said he was glad about the decision, because he knew young women who were tough enough to make it through. He even hoped his teenage daughter would consider it. A few months later, a second letter came from the same man. It was a bulkier envelope, with something tightly wrapped inside. As RBG unraveled it, she found a tiny tin soldier dangling from a pin. The letter writer's mother had just died, leaving behind a pin that had been presented to all of the mothers at her son's VMI graduation ceremony. He thought his mother would have wanted RBG to have it. Chapter 6. Real Love. I have been supportive of my wife since the beginning of time, and she has been supportive of me. It's not sacrifice, it's family. Marty Ginsburg, 1993. This is the story that Marty used to tell. After Bush v. Gore and RBG's firm dissent, the two went to see the play Proof on Broadway. As they made their way back up the aisle for intermission, RBG unmistakable in her trademark scrunchie, the theater boomed with applause as people rose to their feet in appreciation. RBG couldn't help but smile. That's when Marty, professor of tax law and inveterate joker, whispered loudly, "I bet you didn't know there was a convention of tax lawyers in town." RBG playfully smacked her husband in the stomach. When Marty told this story in public, he would say it fairly captures our nearly 50-year happy marriage. It was a story that was about her, and people admiring her for standing up for what she believed in. But it was also about Marty. Marty being irreverent and funny, Marty being the opposite of the reserved RBG, and Marty bringing out a side of her that no one saw unless Marty was there. It was hard to believe it happened, but Clerk David Toscano saw it with his own two eyes in Chambers. The justice jokingly chasing Marty around her desk with scissors. The reason why has been lost to history. He teased her publicly about how the Supreme Court knew nothing about tax law, about her favorite snack of prunes, and she pretended to be put out. In his official biography on his law firm's website, in words that could only have been Marty's, he was described as having stood very low in his class and played on the golf team. Marty wore short-sleeved dress shirts and worn-out golf shirts, even sometimes around the office. He told everyone how his wife had made law review at Harvard and he hadn't. With the same fondly amused grin he usually wore, Marty would portray himself as the lucky guy who came along for the ride of a lifetime, who moved to Washington when his wife got a good job. It was a bit of a shtick. RBG, said her former clerk Margot Schlanger, didn't have a husband the way many men have wives, meaning women who subsume themselves to their husbands' careers. The model was of equality, where they both were crazy superstars in their own realms. Marty's tax law chops earned him clients like Ross Perot, the adulation of his peers, and millions of dollars. So when RBG was asked how she had managed to have such an extraordinary marriage, she often answered by saying that Marty himself was extraordinary, and saw the same in her. "He thought that I must be pretty good," RBG said, "because why would he decide that he wanted to spend his life with me?" Toward the end of his life, Marty got a little more serious. According to Nina Totenberg, Marty told a friend, "I think that the most important thing I have done is enable Ruth to do what she has done." Making Partner. At her confirmation hearings, RBG introduced Marty to the country with the phrase she had been using since the 1970s, her life's partner. Each day, he would carry her briefcase into the Senate hearing room and spread out her papers on the desk. In Stephen Wiesenfeld's testimony at the hearings, he said he and his wife, like the Ginsburgs, had been among the pioneers of alternative family lifestyles. From the outside, neither Ginsburg seemed like anyone's version of alternative. In New York, they had lived on the posh Upper East Side, on East 69th Street, and sent their children to Dalton and Brearley, private schools for the city's elite. Marty used to sardonically describe his work as having been devoted to protecting the deservedly rich from the predations of the poor and downtrodden. On weekends, they golfed. But if RBG hoped for a world in which men and women were freed of stereotypes, with full and mutual participation at both work and home, she could look to her own enduring marriage as an example. It had sustained her even in the years where the answer elsewhere had always been no. "Fortunately, in my marriage, I didn't get second-class treatment," she said. What Wiesenfeld meant by alternative, and what was hinted by RBG's use of the phrase life partner, was a marriage in which the woman didn't lose herself and her autonomy, in which two humans shared their lives and goals on equal footing. It wasn't so common anywhere, least of all among people who came of age in the 1950s. Bert Newborn, about a decade younger and married to another feminist attorney, remembers trying to tell Marty how much he tried to emulate him. It was impossible to praise him. He wouldn't accept it. He shrugged it off. He turned it into a joke. "You're not going to blame that one on me." I said, "Marty, this is a new era. We all need role models." In 1993, when the New York Times reported on the unusually active role Marty had taken in RBG's nomination, and the fact that he had over a decade earlier moved to Washington for her spot on the D.C. circuit, Marty did not congratulate himself. "I have been supportive of my wife since the beginning of time," he said, "and she has been supportive of me. It's not sacrifice, it's family." No one had been surprised that RBG had left Harvard for her husband's career, but she saw it as a give and take. "In the course of a marriage, one accommodates the other," RBG told me. So, for example, when Marty was intent on becoming a partner in a New York law firm in 5 years, during that time, I was the major caretaker of our home and then child. In Washington, RBG crashed her car into a gate, so Marty began driving his wife to the federal courthouse every day, until her Supreme Court appointment entitled her to her own car and driver. He read reams of books and told her which ones were worth taking a break from briefs. At parties, where she was inclined to hang back, he kept her moving around the room with gracious ease. Marty often had to drag RBG out of the office. When she promised she would leave but hung on to do one more thing, Marty sometimes sang to her a line from Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance, "Yes, but you don't go." Asked once if her husband ever gave her advice, RBG replied that the advice was generally for her to come home and eat dinner. He would start calling at 7:30, and by 9 she would have relented, and when she stayed up nights working, his advice was for her to go to sleep. "Well, it's not that bad advice," Marty, sitting beside her, replied. "You have to eat one meal a day, and you should go to sleep sometimes." RBG paused to look at her husband lovingly, and then went on. "The principal advice that I have gotten from Marty throughout my life is that he always made me feel like I was better than I thought myself. I started out by being very unsure. Could I do this brief? Could I make this oral argument? To now where I am. I look at my colleagues and I say, it's a hard job, but I can do it at least as well as those guys." Chef Supreme. Marty and RBG were lucky, they realized in retrospect, that soon after marrying they got sent to a military base in Oklahoma. Spending almost 2 years away from everything they knew, Marty said, allowed the two to learn about each other and begin to build a life. For the first time in their lives, they had time. "I had a job that, quite literally, required my undivided attention 4 hours every week," Marty quipped of his army time. "You may as well just share jobs." That didn't necessarily mean splitting everything down the middle, but doing whatever you did a little better or liked a little more, or disliked less. It turned out there was something Marty did a little better. It all started with tuna casserole, or at least something RBG called tuna casserole. At Fort Sill one night, right after they were married, she dutifully presented the dish. That was her job, after all. Or one of them. Marty squinted at the lumpy mass.
What is it?
And then he taught himself how to cook. The Escoffier cookbook had been a wedding gift from RBG's cousin Richard. The legendary French chef had made his name at hotels like the Ritz in Paris and the Savoy in London. It was not exactly everyday fare for two younger working parents on a military base in Oklahoma. But Marty found that his chemistry skills came in handy, and he began working his way through the book. Still, for years, the daily cooking was still RBG's reluctant territory. Her repertoire included thawing a frozen vegetable and some meat. "I had 7 things I could make," RBG said. "And when we got to number 7, we went back to number 1. Jane isn't sure she saw a fresh vegetable until she was sent to France the summer she turned 14. Around that time, she decided, as RBG put it to me, that Mommy should be phased out of the kitchen altogether. RBG cooked her last meal in 1980. The division of labor in the family, Jane would say, developed into this. Mommy does the thinking, and Daddy does the cooking. Growing up, James says, he got used to people asking him what his father did for a living, when his mother did something pretty interesting, too. In Washington, the Ginsburg's shelves held more cookbooks than tax books. They filled 3 sets of shelves from floor to ceiling in the living room. Marty would consume cookbooks like they were mystery novels. "I hate Marty Ginsburg," Roger Wilkins, a friend of the couple's, once declared on a panel. "It's not because in a town known for its ephemeral passions he's carrying on this lifelong love affair with this wonderful woman. It's because he cooks." In his house, Wilkins said, he was constantly asked, "Why can't you be like Marty?" Marty's recipes, joked another friend, were the edible version of the Internal Revenue Code. So RBG ate well, and slowly. Marty used to joke that it was a good thing Bill Clinton hadn't asked her to lunch at the White House, as he had asked Stephen Breyer, or else they'd still be eating. Jane's Mommy Works. RBG had long known that pregnancy singled women out for unequal treatment, parenting even more so. "What is very hard for most women is what happens when children are born," she said. "Will men become equal parents, sharing the joys as well as the burdens of bringing up the next generation? But that's my dream for the world, for every child to have 2 loving parents who share in raising the child." Her friends say that's what she had most of the time, especially in the early years when Jane was little. Having read that the first year of a child's life is when the personality is formed, Marty threw himself into caring for Jane while they were living in Oklahoma. He played classical music for her and took over the 2 a.m. feeding because it was easier for him to fall back asleep. Life in New York was another story. The mother of one of Jane's classmates at Brearley told her daughter to be extra nice to Jane because, the woman said pityingly, "Jane's mommy works." Marty was working to establish himself at his law firm, Weil, Gottschall & Manges, and it was easy enough to fall into what was expected. True, the Ginsburgs agreed that unless there was something urgent, they would both be home by 7 o'clock for dinner. Marty's firm was reputed to be one of the biggest sweatshops in town, as RBG put it. But even without Marty putting in late nights, she said, somehow the tax department flourished. Still, falling into what was expected meant twice the burden for RBG, who was climbing the academic ladder while juggling care for baby James, born 10 years after Jane. She had already gotten used to doing so much, but her patience with her husband wore thin. In 1969, she reportedly rebuked him, "Your son is now 4 years old and you've never taken him to the park." Marty said he looked back at it with some regret. "But it was also the way things were," he said. Not forever. The balance shifted around the time RBG added the ACLU Women's Rights Project and Supreme Court advocacy to her docket. Teachers at the Dalton School had begun calling her constantly, complaining that James, then in elementary school, had gotten into trouble again. One day, he remembers, he snuck into the old-fashioned elevator unattended, very much against the rules. Unluckily for him, the door opened right into the face of the janitor. When the school called his mother, she lost it. "This child has 2 parents," she declared, asking them to alternate calls with her husband, starting with this one. RBG liked to say the calls decreased after that, because the school was loath to bother an important corporate attorney at work. James believes the calls take